Next speaker is Joe Gallucci. Joe's an archivist for the Pacifica Radio Archives in Studio City, California. He's been involved with PRA, Pacifica Radio Archives, since 2009, when he first interned at the archives for its LBGT, Activism Audio Preservation Project, funded by a grant from the Institute for Museum and Library Sciences. He graduated from NYU's Moving Image Archiving and Preservation's Master's Program in 2010. This is his first ARS conference, and I hope he's enjoying it as much as I think many of you are. He's now going to talk about the, is it the Free Store Program?
Free Music
Store. Free Music Store. Joe?
Okay, thank you for having me. So my name's Joseph Gallucci, and I am one of the archivists at the Pacifica Radio Archives in Studio City, California. My task as an archivist there is to help preserve, digitize, catalog, and make accessible radio programs that were broadcast on the airwaves of Pacifica Radio, which is the country's oldest non-commercial listener-sponsored radio network and consists of five sister stations, as you can see here, KPFA Berkeley, KPFK Los Angeles, WBAI New York, WPFW Washington, D.C., and KPFT Houston. Today I'm going to be, I'll just go back to the screen. Today I'm going to be talking about the Free Music Store, which was a concert series that ran from 1968 to 1978 at WBAI-FM Studios in New York City. Per the title of this talk, A Place Where Things Happen, I'm going to first discuss the place and then talk about some of the things that happened there. So the Free Music Store was the brainchild of the composer and critic Eric Salzman, who was hired as director of WBAI's music department in 1968. He had worked there in a similar capacity from 1963 to 1964, taking time off in between his stints there to work on his own compositions and writing. And at the time of his rehiring, he was also the programmer of the New Image of Sound Contemporary Art and Music series at Hunter College. He announced in the WBAI program folio of November 1968 his ideas for WBAI's music department, which included a 48-hour electronic music marathon, the Scratchy Awards, which would honor the worst records of the year, and something he had conceived of called the Free Music Store, which borrowed its name from the free stores that were organized by the radical San Francisco activists, the Diggers. These were stores that were like ad hoc storefronts filled with discarded items where customers could just go in and take whatever they felt like taking. But Salzman had hoped that the Free Music Store would be, and I quote, "a place, a means, a context, a cellar, a loft, a medium, a message, somewhere, some place where things can happen. Music and other kinds of artistic communication as well. Outside of the music biz, outside of the culture center culture syndrome, and outside the concert museum formats which presently dominate live music. Young performers and groups will appear with musics ranging from electronic to jazz, from avant to derriere, from Renaissance to rock, from rags to raga, from boulez to baroque, from classical string quartet to electric string quartet, from cage to chant. The idea is to make music without the conventional rituals and without the formality of the concert, but instead with the most direct and immediate contact and communication. It'll be a place to go, free but will tactfully ask for contributions, and a place where things can happen. There'll be two or three groups of performers an evening and some kind of refreshments." Salzman went on to note that the Free Music Store was at that point just a twinkle in his eye, considering that WBAI's space at the time could not easily accommodate his vision. Fortuitously, Salzman was able to procure the Martinson Hall at Joseph Papp's Public Theater on Astor Place on two conditions: that he could only use it during off hours when there were no theatrical commitments, and that proceeds from the door be split 50-50 with the public theater. This being the case, the first Free Music Store concerts were held on Saturday nights at midnight. Martinson Hall lacked any kind of seating, so audience members were asked to bring in pillows and blankets to sit on, though some intrepid concertgoers would sit in the windows on especially crowded nights. And a WBAI staffer was stationed by the door to solicit donations from people on the way out. Performers were never compensated for performing except in special cases when bands needed cab fare to arrive to the venue with bulky instruments. Refreshments were provided, usually apple juice and snacks, and smoking was expressly forbidden inside the venue, unless you were a performer. The series was a success from the start, and as it became more popular, they expanded to both Wednesday and Saturday nights, the public theater. The final concert at Martinson Hall took place on January 31st, 1971. As the series garnered more attention, they required more and more use of the space. However, Joseph Papp, who had only begrudgingly offered them the space in the first place, preferring that the venue be used mainly for theatrical purposes, had promised the use of the hall to a choreographer to rehearse his new show. Papp thus sent his temporary tenants 2 weeks' notice that they had to find another venue as their use of the space was cutting into valuable rehearsal time. That's a picture of Robert Posar, the drummer, performing at Martinson Hall. At the same time, WBAI itself was searching for a new home. When Salzman came back to work at WBAI, their studios were located at a townhouse in Murray Hill on East 39th Street, but they were looking to expand into a larger space. The station had its eye on the former Bethesda Covenant Church at 359 East 62nd Street on New York's Upper East Side, which you can see a picture of here. This stretch of the city was a considerable no-man's land at the time. There was very little else in the neighborhood aside from an Italian restaurant that was next door to the station. They purchased the church for $185,000, partially using funds raised from a pledge drive that took place in the spring of 1969. The new facilities contained 3 stories filled with studios, rehearsal spaces, and staff offices. The church was outfitted with then state-of-the-art stereo equipment, which enabled the free music store to broadcast live. All of the Martinson Hall concerts were recorded by remote. WBAI officially moved into the church in late 1970, and then while they were remodeling it, the free music store performed at a few itinerant locations in the meantime, including the Washington Square Methodist Church on West 4th Street. And then it settled into the church on 62nd, and it was held at the station's Studio C for the next 7 years. And here are some more photos from the WBAI program folio advertising their new space, some more interior and exterior shots, and then this was their kind of proposed architectural plan that they had proposed for the space. So the phrase that Salzman frequently used to invoke the free music store, and from which I named this talk, is a place where things happen. So what actually did happen there? So the inaugural free music store performance was held on December 21st, 1968. It was a Renaissance and Baroque-themed Christmas program featuring the New York motet singers under the direction of Joshua Rifkin and Joseph Hansen. The next few performances included the Wind Ensemble Workshop led by Henry Schumann, an evening pairing Renaissance music with recent electronic works by Eric Salzman, and a percussion chamber quintet. The Free Music Store extended Pacifica's longstanding policy of giving generous airtime to live performance of Baroque and classical music. WBAI's early days were in fact marked by a lot of infighting as to whether the station would serve as a platform for classical music or for political discussion. If you know anything about WBAI now, you know that which side of that argument won. It also provided a home for the early music revival as well, with ensembles such as the Western Wind and the Philidor Trio performing early madrigals and motets. The Free Music Store staged classical performance without the pretensions of the concert hall. During one memorable performance at the Martinson Hall, all six of Bach's Brandenburg concertos, a drunk vagrant from the Bowery wandered into the hall, curious as to what all the ruckus was about. Seeing that there were no seats in the audience, he spotted a vacant chair on the stage where the performers were playing and proceeded to occupy it for the remainder of the show. Neither the audience nor the performers asked him to leave, and he dozed away while the show continued, woken only by the occasional percussive blast. Then that's a cover. That's the Cleveland String Quartet. They made the cover of the WBAI folio in 1972. This classical tendency of the Free Music Store was tempered by an equally strong experimental streak. In December of 1969, the Free Music Store attempted a marathon of 40 consecutive nights of performances, which included not just music and film, but also film and notably video screenings, because video art was still pretty much in its infancy at this point, and also dance performances. 6 of these evenings featured Daniel Negrin, the choreographer and dancer whose multimedia theatrical work, The Peloponnesian War, debuted at the Free Music Store. The music for his performance was scored by Eric Salzman and Archie Shepp, with accompanying libretto voiced by the actor Frank Langella. The pioneering video artists Woody Vasulka and Steina created a video document of one of the performances. The two of them also showed some of their work at the Free Music Store before they founded The Kitchen, which is a seminal video art performance space in New York. The ragtime renaissance of the 1970s that had culminated in The Sting arguably might not have happened without Eric Salzman and the Free Music Store. In the 60s, it was difficult to track down original ragtime sheet music anywhere, but a handful of collectors, including Salzman, William Bolcom, Dan Paget, and Joshua Rifkin, held private sessions where they would gather at someone's home to play Rags by Scott Joplin, UB Blake, Joseph Lamb, and others. With the Free Music Store, Salzman finally had a venue to showcase these rags, performed in both new and faithful arrangements by himself and others. The first ragtime concert at WBAI was held in 1970 and was given the tongue-in-cheek title, the 12th Annual Ragtime Revival Concert, and they soon became an annual staple of the Free Music Store. Günther Schuller was apparently so inspired by, or was at least partially inspired by the success of these concerts when he started the New England Ragtime Ensemble at the New England Conservatory, and where they played and recorded some of his own Red Back Book arrangements of Joplin's rags. A number of the original ragtime pianists were actually still alive at the time of these concerts, and they managed to track down UB Blake, who was living in Brooklyn, and brought him in to perform at the Free Music Store. And electronic music and performance arguably also found its footing at the Free Music Store as well. To name one example, Mother Mallard's Portable Masterpiece Company, whose album cover is here, they were the world's first or earliest synthesizer ensemble, and they performed twice at the Free Music Store, often with accompanying animations. According to Mother Mallard's David Borden, the director William Friedkin discovered the group through a Free Music Store broadcast and asked if they would like to compose some music for his upcoming film, The Exorcist. Only two short pieces of theirs made it into the final film, but it's still kind of a tantalizing what-if story for any early electronic synthesizer buffs here. And I've focused mostly on the performers so far, but it needs to be stressed that part of what made the Free Music Store special was the audience as much as it was the performers themselves. Because the concerts were so informal, thanks to the lack of seating and the free admission, audiences weren't afraid to interact with the performers, and many of the performers encouraged this intimacy. When the esteemed harpsichordist Igor Kipnis performed at Martinson Hall, the crowd turnout was so big that people sat underneath his harpsichord while he played. Much like the vocally critical audiences of New York's theater houses in the early 19th century, Free Music Store audiences weren't afraid to voice their pleasure or displeasure with the proceedings, such as when an evening of country fiddlin' assembled by Tom Whitmore that took place in 1972, it inspired such an enthusiastic audience reaction that it nearly literally brought the house down, thanks to the entire church stomping their feet and clapping their hands. On the other hand, the avant-garde composer Alvin Lucier was booed after his performance, but he nevertheless engaged the audience in a Q&A afterwards to explain the work he was performing. And at least one performer incorporated the experience of the Free Music Store into his own performance practice, namely the French composer Pierre Boulez, who took a cue from the Free Music Store when he did his own rug concerts, in which he removed the seating and the orchestra and audience and replaced them with carpets and rubber cushions. Most crucial to the success of the Free Music Store, though, is that the audiences who showed up were typically game for anything. It was rare that Studio C wasn't totally packed, and it brought together people from all sorts of class and race backgrounds. The intermingling of uptown classical buffs with East Village folky types and Eddie Palmieri fans from the South Bronx was not wholly unusual. And for many audience members, it was their first exposure to certain kinds of music. At this point in time, it wasn't easy to come by Macedonian fiddle playing or Brazilian berimbau performance or an entire concert of sea shanties. Throughout its run, the series was committed to presenting a diverse and eclectic slate of musical acts, some of whom were locals, some of whom were just passing through. The programming at the Free Music Store changed hands a few times over the course of its run on WBAI. Salzman, who had coordinated the series with Barbara Oka, Tony Elitcher, and Dan Cavanaugh, left WBAI himself in 1972. And that's Barbara Oka introducing the Cleveland String Quartet. Candy Cohen took over from her when she left, and Ira Weitzman, who is now the director of musical theater at Lincoln Center, commandeered it after her. The series was engineered by award-winning producers such as David Rapkin, Steve Rath, and Seal Muller. At the series' height, live broadcasts happened once a week. All others were rebroadcast at later dates, and many were rebroadcast by popular demand. The Free Music Store recordings were routinely distributed to all of the other Pacifica stations, ensuring that they were heard across the country. Pacifica's KPFT-FM even tried their own hand at having a Free Music Store at their studios in Houston. The idea also spread to the State University of New York, Albany, where a regular series of experimental performances called the Free Music Store took place for a time, organized by the composer Joel Chidabe. Several official and unofficial Free Music Store recordings have circulated amongst record and tape traders. The only one of these that's actually technically a bootleg is the Patti Smith Group one in the upper left-hand corner. That performance is from 1975. It's before her first album came out. And she actually talks about it in her book, Just Kids. She mentions it near the end. The other albums here are Milford Graves, Bobby. The bottom left is Joe McPhee in Survival Unit 2. And the bottom right is the percussionist Laji Kamara from Guinea. Those are all Free Music Store recordings that were released on kind of legitimate labels. The Free Music Store remained free to audiences for much of the 1970s, but in truth the series carried on at considerable expense to the station itself, who ate up all the costs for overhead. WBAI did receive grant funding from the New York State Council of the Arts to support the show for a while, but larger financial troubles were plaguing the station. In December of 1977, WBAI announced in its program folio that they had to sell off the church, thanks largely to an adverse ruling by the New York City Real Estate Tax Commission contesting their tax-exempt status. The station had owed $150,000 in back taxes dating back to the initial purchase of the building. WBAI sold the church in 1978, relocating to a much smaller space on 8th Avenue and West 35th. And with that, the Free Music Store lost its venue. For a brief period of time, the Free Music Store partnered with Symphony Space to present shows there, but they were forced to charge $3, which meant they had to change their name to the WBAI Music Store. By the end of the year, the Free Music Store had effectively fizzled out. It was briefly revived in 1983 thanks to grant funding from NISCA and the NEA and was held at PS 41 in the West Village. The series lasted only a year before it stopped for good. In accounts of the experimental music scene in New York City of the time, the Free Music Store was often spoken of in the same breath along with more prestigious places like The Kitchen, La Mama, and Roulette. Those venues all still exist today, whereas the Free Music Store more or less petered out before the 1980s. It's worth noting, however, that the Free Music Store was rarely ever advertised outside of WBAI. Some shows were given brief write-ups in the New York Times, The Village Voice, and New York Magazine, but for the most part, the attendees of Free Music Store shows were WBAI listeners and their friends. A concert series that was put on for free at least once a week that was supported through audience donations and where performers played for either love or the chance for exposure, but not money, was never going to be entirely tenable, but for the brief span of time in which it existed, the Free Music Store demonstrated what things could happen when guided by the ideals of free democratic culture, the very ideals propagated by Joseph Papp himself when he founded Shakespeare in the Park and the Public Theater. I'm just going to exit out of this for a bit. In 2013, the Pacifica Radio Archives applied for a grant from the Grammy Foundation to preserve the Free Music Store recordings in our collection. The grant was written by myself, the director of the archives, and my boss, Brian DeShazer, and our preservation consultant, Addie Gevins. Though the total number of actual Free Music Store performances numbers probably in the hundreds, we only have 33 of these recordings in our vaults, all of which are on quarter-inch open reel tape. And I would like to publicly acknowledge George Blood Audio and Video for all of their great work that they did in digitizing these recordings for us. This grant was also the first one to make extensive use of our newly redesigned online public access catalog, which you can see here. A lot of the work on that was done by my co-archivist, Jolene Beiser, who did wonderful work on this. Our catalog now conforms to PB Core standards, and it includes some fun extras like scans of the original box art, which you can see here. And then also a link to the digitized program folio where you can actually find the listing for where it would have appeared when you subscribe to the folio, like the listing that would describe what it actually is. And so far we have used, and we also have a preservation project page on our website where you can see more about this. I should also mention that this wasn't the only series of recordings that we got preserved through the Grammy grant. We also did a series called the Mind's Eye Theater that was kind of experimental radio theater that was roughly contemporaneous with the Free Music Store. And we also have done 5 episodes of From the Vault, which is our weekly radio program where we rebroadcast older programs from our archive. We've used 5 of the Free Music Store recordings for that. We've done the Country Fiddling one, which I have up here. We did the 3rd annual Ragtime Revival reunion, a cello masterclass taught by Janos Starker, who recently passed away, Seals and Crofts, who were the biggest act to ever come through the Free Music Store, probably, and a really great performance of Igor Stravinsky's The Soldier's Tale. And this being North Carolina, I was going to play a clip from the Country Fiddling program. It's not actually North Carolina, but this is the legendary bluegrass fiddler Tex Logan. And here he is being backed by the Apple County String Band, and they're performing Fire in the Mountain.
Come on, hit it. Speed it up out there a little bit. Come on.
It's playing so fast the audience can't even keep up with it.
I'm a rock in Arkansas. Find a man, run a boy, run. Find his hunkin' his son. Let's go. Let's go.
Play me out as well. Thank you so much.
Are there any questions for Marshall that we need to get through yet either? While we're changing.
Man made. Is the old Chicago poet, man may yet win.